This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
There has been a big push in schools across the country to emphasize STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. And there's been a big push to encourage girls to take up those topics. But what happens when those girls become women?
Sort of like being a mother somehow affected your ability to do your work.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a look at the challenges women face working in the STEM fields. We'll also learn about a different kind of STEM occupation, sound engineering. Go back in time to take another look at time travel and spend an academic minute with the shrinking number of international adoptions. I'm Bob Barron, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math, have traditionally been dominated by men, and that can make it tough for women to break in or gain respect. The Me Too movement is highlighting those issues, and some female professionals in the Great Lakes region have their own stories about the culture of gender bias. From station WBFO, Angelica Morrison has more for the series Great Lakes Today.
Inside the Great Lakes Center field station, which is just a few miles away from the Buffalo State campus, Alicia Perez Fuente Taha checks on a collection of tiny pet fish.
What are they? Are those pet shiners?
Yeah, well, that is a spot pail shiner.
The field station is where some of her research takes place. She's an aquatic ecologist known for her work with emerald shiners and the detection of antidepressants in the brains of fish from the Niagara River. She says as a woman, building a career in the sciences isn't easy.
When females around in the field would get pregnant or got married, the comments from the fellow males would be like, poof, she's out of the game now, or she's having kids, you can count on her now. Sort of like being a mother somehow affected your ability to do your work. And those comments are common, and sometimes they're pretty harsh.
Perez Fuente Taha says change begins to happen when women learn to speak up.
Another hurdle for women: if you're doing very well, a man would go speak to your dean and ask for a raise. A woman will not. Or if they ask for a raise, it's for a little tiny raise, not a big one, right?
In a recent survey of female STEM professionals who work in predominantly male environments, 78% say they've experienced discrimination. In that same Pew Research Group survey, close to 50% say they've experienced sexual harassment or their gender has made it hard for them to succeed in their field. Monica Deuce knows that feeling well. She's an assistant professor of molecular, cellular, and developmental biology at the University of Michigan. Back in her undergraduate years about a decade ago, she recalls a day when she was sent home because she was wearing pink boots. It was during a science program where she was showing high school students various experiments.
It was 8:30 a.m. and I was told I had to go change my pink shoes because it wasn't professional for a scientist to wear pink.
Unfortunately, the problems didn't stop with the color of her shoes. Now, she's uncomfortable repeating some of the things said to her over the years, but there's one experience she did share.
I was quite thin, and one of the male graduate students asked me if I got my periods because I was so thin.
University at Buffalo engineering professor Liesl Folks is working to combat some of these issues. She's leading a program aimed at giving students the tools to deal with gender bias. Right now, she's starting a session with a group of about 20 students.
A lot of time to think and reflect on what you learned at the retreat, and are all sort of energized for what we're going to learn today at the workshop.
She says all too often women in STEM choose to abandon their careers because of gender-based conflicts at work.
So what we see is it's very, very, very common for women when they hit these barriers to take that first step. They will usually take some kind of an action.
And the first step is to tell management or human resources.
If it turns out badly and that first action doesn't result in a positive change in their working environment, then often what they do is just go back to their office and say, I'm just going to avoid the situation, I'm going to work harder, than I ever did. I'm going to do better work, and I will be recognized for my better work, and I'm just going to try and stay out of the way of whatever else is going on that's negative. But that ends up being soul-destroying.
Some of the skills she teaches in the program include forming alliances with coworkers. This will help provide support if something should happen. Also, before jumping ship, female STEM professionals should clearly evaluate all of their options. For WBFO News, this is Angelica Morrison.
Great Lakes Today is a collaboration of WBFO in Buffalo, Idea Stream Cleveland, and WXXI Rochester. For more stories, visit greatlakestoday.org. So what does a woman working in the STEM fields look like? Is it a scientist in a white lab coat holding a test tube up to the light, or a brilliant computer geek hunched over a keyboard? Well, these, of course, are stereotypes. But there are a lot of industries involving STEM skills that don't fit those stereotypes. When you think of STEM, do you think of audio engineers? Terry Winston does. According to some estimates, 95% of all audio engineers are men, but that is changing, as Jen Chien reports from San Francisco for the program Cross Currents.
You're an inspiration to all of us.
I'm in.
Right then, who's next?
Pick me.
Yes, the little Sheila down the front.
Woo!
Come on up here.
Hi, I'm Dory.
Hi, Dory.
In a darkened room, 12 middle school girls are watching a scene from the animated Pixar movie, Finding Nemo.
Good night.
This isn't a slumber party. It's a class. The girls are paying close attention to the movie with their pens poised over notebooks. But what they're paying attention to isn't what they're watching. It's what they're hearing. When the clip is over, their teacher, Kelly Coyne, asks a question.
Hey. So, I'm looking for raised hands for different sound effects you heard.
Water.
Yeah, so when the fish were moving around in the ocean, was it silent?
No.
What else? There's something in the water that we heard a bunch.
Bubbles, yeah.
So different bubbling sounds.
Coyne explains how those bubbly, swishing water sounds help bring the story to life. The girls nod in understanding. After they learn about sound effects, they're going to add their own sounds to a cartoon.
Ooh, you guys can take turns being SpongeBob.
The girls here are students from a public school in San Francisco's Mission District, but this is a special off-campus class called Girls on the Mic. After splitting up into small groups, they gather around computer workstations to record.
It needs to be an input mode. So you see under dialogue, It has that eye needs to be clicked.
Oh. Girls on the Mic is run by Women's Audio Mission, an organization dedicated to teaching the recording arts to women and girls.
We're in the control room of Women's Audio Mission, so we're the only professional recording studio in the world run entirely by women.
That's Terry Winston. She founded Women's Audio Mission 11 years ago when she was a professor of recording arts at City College. She first learned to work with sound as a musician.
You know, I'm an old punk rocker, so that's where I started out.
She's also an electrical engineer, or as they say in the biz, a double E.
Double E electrical engineering, sorry.
That's the insider lingo.
It's totally insider. It's funny because there's a lot of audio people that are double E's, so we bond over it.
Winston is part of a rare club. Women make up only a small fraction of all double E's. She's a self-admitted gearhead. She is really into microphones.
They all sound different. They all look different. Different materials, different transducers inside. I mean, it's like wine. You know, when people talk about wine and they're so obsessed, it's like that's kind of how I am with microphones.
Winston knows her kind of obsession is still unusual for girls, but it's something she wants to see more of.
Girls are not socialized to be the gadget people. Just seeing them with a microphone is just the most crazy, empowering thing to witness. And it's like the amount of energy that comes out of that is better than caffeine. It's incredible.
Winston says music and sound are perfect as a way of getting girls interested in subjects they might not approach on their own.
If we say we're going to teach you math today, or we're going to teach you science today, or the physics of sound today, you know, they're going to run for the hills. But if we say, okay, let's... you know, listen to this, you know, Rihanna song and then let's break it down. And, oh, musical principles are based on math. Hey, this is 4-4 and this is how you count it. Sound is such a natural introduction to physics. And it's so easy to explain because analog technology is so easy to explain. The air moving is so easy to explain, you know, to a middle school girl. We love doing that.
The girls take their new physics and math skills and use them. They make sound for movies.
Okay, my turn.
They create their own podcasts.
Good morning, Bay Area. This is your fave news reporter, Rosemary, of Channel 2 News. Today, we have discovered that scientists in Washington, D.C. have discovered a new infectious disease, and the symptoms are meowing, biting people, and becoming a zombie cat. Now, I'm going
They even record their own songs.
Yo te di todo mi amor, pero lo echaste a la basura.
Terry Winston says unleashing creativity and thinking critically are just as important as mastering the technical stuff.
I think my science and engineering training, it really taught me to be a problem solver and to be really self-sufficient and also to be very confident then that when there's a problem, I don't run away from it.
That can-do attitude is at the heart of Women's Audio Mission. Winston says there are a lot more women in the industry now, but there's more work to be done. She still runs into people who underestimate her just because she's a woman.
It happens all the time. But I think it happens just as much to somebody at Starbucks or, you know, I think it's a pervasive thing. We, you know, I chose to start Women's Audio Mission to focus on the thing that I knew really well. And I knew that we could change it.
How do you mute it?
Winston says that change starts from the ground up with these girls sitting in groups at recording stations. The next generation of brilliant problem-solving gearheads may just come from right here.
What do you do to press record? It's not just space bar, right?
It's command space.
Yep.
Ready?
No.
Yeah. Go. And go.
I'm friends with the monster, the son of my bed.
On the mic, I'm Jen Sheehan for Cross Currents.
Still to come, we love time travel. We love it so much, we're going to go back in time and listen again to a segment on time travel. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Ever since H.G. Wells introduced us to his time machine, stories about time travel have been a staple for science fiction writers and fans, and it appears we can't get enough of them. That's where James Gleick comes in. James Gleick is a best-selling science and technology author who took a look at our fascination with time travel in his book, Time Travel, A History. We spoke about the book when it came out last year, and I asked him why it was the right time to write about time and time travel.
Well, I have written about time before, now and again, here and there. I've been writing about science pretty much my whole career, and time enters into it now and then. And I didn't intend to write a book about time because that would be insane. It's too big and difficult a subject. But time travel seemed like a more modest thing to write about. And what made me think that there was actually a story to tell was the discovery that it's a relatively new idea, that time travel hasn't been part of the human imagination all through our history, which I did assume. It really dates back very specifically to H.G. Wells in 1895 and his first book, The Time Machine.
And really, every conversation about time travel has to start with H.G. Wells, doesn't it?
Well, it makes sense to start with him because that's really where the idea enters our culture. And because it's an idea and it's finite and it has a starting point, you can watch it evolve and you can watch people, you can watch a sort of global conversation take place over the generations.
And why does this concept of traveling through time fascinate us? Why do we care so much? And we really do, because those stories, time travel stories, though they make your head hurt, to me, they're like some of the best stories told in science fiction.
Yeah, I've always felt that way, too, and I had to try and figure out why I felt that way. One reason is just the twistiness of them gives you a kind of pleasure if your mind works a certain way. But more than that, time is really important to us. It's the last great mystery. It's the last frontier. We have regrets. We wish we could go back and do something over. That's entirely, I believe, a human behavior. I mean, I love my dog, and I think my dog is a surprisingly intelligent creature, but I am quite sure that he never stops and thinks, well, if only I had done X, you know, I'd be getting a cookie now. And similarly, as humans, we have the ability to imagine ourselves in the future, to project ourselves forward in time, and to speculate about what might be and what might have been, about alternative realities. And this is imagination firing on all cylinders. And you can't start reading time travel stories and exploring its history without bumping up against the most difficult and fundamental human questions, I think.
Well, the other thing you bump up against, and you do speak about this in the book, are paradoxes. And I think this is what makes people's heads hurt the most. Well, if you go back and you do that, then paradoxes are just, they're infinite, aren't they?
Well, they're infinite, and yet there's really only one. All of the many variations are, in a way, the same paradox. And the version of it that a lot of people have heard of is the one called the grandfather paradox, where, for whatever reason, you take your time machine back far enough in time to meet your grandfather, and then you kill him. I don't know why, but that's the hypothesis. And then the result of that is that you were never born. And so now, because you were never born, your grandfather is just fine, and so on. There's no getting out of this loop. Every other paradox that involves going back into the past and changing history and altering something, you know, it's a causal loop. It's retrocausality, the philosophers might say, and there's no escaping it. And many time travel stories and movies succeed by giving you the illusion that there's a solution to the problem. History was changed, but we forgot. Or the time traveler tries to change history but can't for some mysterious reason. It's all a kind of beautiful sleight of hand.
I love the way you describe how turning the pages of a book is really time travel in its own sense.
Well, isn't it? I mean, we tell stories. Our stories have a beginning and a middle and an end. That's what defines a story. And yet, we've got the ability to go back and forth. And sometimes we need to go back and forth. So we can have the luxury of time travel in a story if the story is right in our laps in the pages of a book.
How seriously has time travel been scientifically studied? Like, are people actually trying to figure out how to do this?
I don't think there's any point in that, to be honest with you, but that's because I'm not a scientist. I can say as a sociological matter that if you ask a bunch of science fiction writers, is time travel real? Is it worthy of scientific study? They will pretty unanimously tell you no. But if you ask a bunch of scientists, you get a much more optimistic answer, and lots of physicists will tell you we can't rule it out. Even Einstein's associate, the great logician Kurt Gödel, had a solution to Einstein's equations of relativity in which a certain kind of universe would allow time travel to the past, and he was very excited about that and very proud of that. And there are theoretical physicists today who study wormholes and whether these hypothetical cosmic creatures, if handled correctly, could enable a form of time travel. So, yeah, people think about it, but But if any of our listeners are hoping to get a time machine under the Christmas tree this year, I'm going to predict disappointment.
The government is not funding the time tunnel someplace in Arizona.
Well, no, I don't think they are. Although, again, there are people who will swear to you that the government has some secret time travel projects underway.
As you were going through then and writing this book, what happened? What surprised you as you were going? What did you learn that you didn't think you were going to learn?
Well, two things. One, I learned that I was writing a book about time, after all, that it wasn't just about science fiction. And that was okay. I relaxed into it. But another thing I learned, I guess, is part of the story I tell is about how smart we've gotten about time, how much we've learned, what capable creatures we are. We have a lot of nice technologies that allow us to peer back into the past and project our messages into the future. And I remembered at some point that a piece of advice you often hear is live in the now. Don't worry too much about the past, which you can't control, or the future. Just enjoy the present. That's the best way to live a healthy life. And I realized I don't actually believe that. I think we can do better than living in the now. We're imaginative creatures, and we have the ability to live in the past and the future as well as the now, and we might as well enjoy all that.
Again, the name of James Glick's book is Time Travel, A History. It's published by Vintage Books. The number of children from overseas being adopted by families in the U.S. has dropped. A lot. And that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Fewer and fewer children are being adopted from overseas. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Mark Montgomery, professor of enterprise and leadership at Grinnell College, determines the reasons why international adoption rates are falling.
International adoption is in a state of near collapse. In 2005, almost 46,000 children were adopted across borders. By 2015, the number had dropped by 72%. Why has this happened? One key factor is national pride. South Korea had been sending children to the U.S. since the early 1950s. 6,000 came in 1987 alone. But when, during the 1988 Seoul Olympic Games, the country got criticized for exporting its offspring, the number started falling sharply. In 2016, fewer than 300 Koreans were adopted by Americans. In 2012, Russia ceased all adoptions to the U.S. when Congress sanctioned some Russian officials after an anti-corruption activist died suspiciously in a Moscow jail. Vladimir Putin said, "The country will not be humiliated." Anti-adoption pressure also builds when the Western press reports so-called child trafficking scandals. In a few cases, these scandals involve birth parents being defrauded of their children, not knowing that they would be placed permanently outside the country. More commonly, however, children are said to be trafficked because some impoverished mothers are found to have been compensated for placing a child for adoption. Of course, not everyone laments the decline of international adoption. Some critics say it exploits poor families and is too influenced by commercial interest. UNICEF wants to supplant the practice with local solutions like domestic adoption or family reunification. Our research results suggest, however, that these alternatives have been ineffective at getting many children into stable, permanent homes. Of course, no country will say it's closing adoption due to pride and publicity. They will say that shutting it down is in the best interest of the children. Given how many kids are growing up without permanent families, that argument is not especially convincing.
That was Mark Montgomery of Grinnell College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.